From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
He arrived in the early evening, just as getting dark, checked in, and the motel clerk, of course, remembered him and had some impressions of him. But then he went straight to his room, and as far as anyone knows, he stayed in his room the rest of the night. So there wasn't much opportunity for the other guests to see him. It wasn't one of these things where they had a breakfast room and where James Earl Ray showed up and there might have been a dozen people in the breakfast room. Nothing like that. There was, at least as far as I know, there was no one else at that motel. It's called the New Rebel Motel. No one else who had any recollection of having seen Ray there.
Joseph Rosenblum, author of Redemption, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Last 31 Hours, published by Beacon Press. As America celebrated the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., little was known about the last 31 hours of his life. We all know about I've Been to the Mountaintop speech and why he and SCLC had returned to Memphis, Tennessee, but few details were known about the hours leading up to that fateful night on April 4, 1968. Rosenblum's book, Redemption, traces King's movements and his thoughts during that period. Returning to Memphis between 2006 and 2014, Rosenblum spoke of two dozen people connected to the events of April 3rd and 4th, 1968. Also, he dug into the King archives, the hearing transcripts of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and records from the Memphis Police Department. Returning to Memphis was more than supporting the sanitation workers. It was also about King's Poor People's Campaign. I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Redemption, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Last 31 Hours, Part 2, with author Joseph Rosenblum, In Black America.
Some people said he had almost a photographic memory. And also, he would rework some of the same material. So, I mean, a guy like him who's speaking constantly, he couldn't write a new speech every time he spoke. So a lot of the themes and a lot of the language were familiar to him. And he could do that. He could stand up and he could speak for hours and speak very powerfully and very engagingly for a long time without notes. And that's what happened that night. I don't know, you said you heard that speech. It's an eloquent speech.
Right.
And one can wonder if it would be as well remembered as it is. It's called the Mountaintop Speech.
Exactly.
If it hadn't been killed the next day, but I think that it might well have been, perhaps not as well remembered, but because aspects of that speech were really quite extraordinary. I think it would have been remembered anyway.
When Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his aide boarded Eastern Airlines Flight 381 on the morning of Wednesday, April 3rd, 1968, to Memphis, Tennessee, a lot was on his mind. As the plane was about to take off the first time, there was a bomb threat. 6 days earlier, a march he led in Memphis to support the city's sanitation workers turned into a riot, and his reputation was on the line. Also, he was facing dissent even within the civil rights movement and among his own staff at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and his Poor People's Campaign was lacking progress. In his book, Redemption, author Joseph Rosenblum relived those last 31 hours, from the time he landed in Memphis to 6:01 p.m. on Thursday night at the Lorraine Motel when he was assassinated. Rosenblum spent several years backtracking King movements to give readers a new perspective of what those final hours were like. On today's program, we conclude our conversation with Joseph Rosenblum.
It was obvious the crowd didn't want him to speak. They wanted Dr. King to speak, so then Dr. King readily agreed, and he did go to Mason Temple and deliver the speech.
You talk about James Earl Ray in the book, and it seems like he was an accident waiting to happen, considering that most of his family members had criminal records.
Yes, so crime. His family was rife with crime, and he grew up in a very dysfunctional family. It's hard to imagine a worse conditions than he had, and. As a kid, he was persecuted in school. He dropped out of school in the ninth grade. And so he had a lot going against him. And he tried a few j- jobs and didn't go well. He was in the army and he got essentially kicked out of the army. So he was kind of, he was essentially a loser, long rap sheet. And so yeah, that's right. His beginnings certainly did not foreshadow a particularly bright future for him.
I also found it interesting that the prior police chief in the 50s, when King used to visit Memphis, lended security for Dr. King, but the police chief in 68 wasn't that concerned about his protection, only the surveillance of him when he was in the city.
Yeah, that's right. The predecessor, the guy who was the police director in 68 is a guy named Frank Holloman.
Holloman, right.
His predecessor, guy named Claude Armour, the police chief, and Dr. King was in Memphis in 1966. Briefly, he was. That was when he went to Mississippi to support James Meredith's March Against Fear.
Mm-hmm.
And during that visit in 1966, Claude Armour said, "Well, we're going to protect Dr. King. If anything happens to Dr. King while he's here," he told his security detail that he assigned to protect, "then you're going to be handing in your badge." That's how determined he was to protect Dr. King. And he did have a large security detail of African-American officers who protected him. There's something like, I think there's like eight of them or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And by contrast, when Dr. King came to Memphis in 1968 on his first two visits, there was no police protection for him. And then on his last visit on April the 3rd and 4th, there was police protection only for about 8 hours.
8 hours, right.
On the 3rd, and then it was discontinued, so there was no protection for him on the 4th.
After 5 o'clock, right.
That's right. And I think the reason was it was indifference. The Holloman and the other top people in the police department just didn't care that much about King's safety. They figured, well, he could fend for himself, and they didn't assign a high priority to his security.
Yeah, sorry to say that Holloman was from the J. Edgar Hoover School of, I guess, policing.
Well, he had been a top official at the FBI.
Right.
And Hoover believed, first of all, you may be familiar with the whole smear campaign.
Exactly.
That the FBI had undertaken against Dr. King for years. And also, Hoover very much believed in covert monitoring of people such as Dr. King, surveillance. And Holloman adopted that approach to law enforcement as well. And when he arrived in Memphis, he established a department for that. And that's the way he handled the visit of Dr. King. There were two African-American officers who were assigned to surveillance. And then, as I described a moment ago, not much emphasis on security.
Whatever happened to the injunction?
The injunction was eventually lifted, but the judge who had initially issued the injunction imposed some restrictions.
Was that Judge Brown?
No, that was Judge Bailey Brown,
okay.
The U.S. District Court judge in Memphis. He imposed some restrictions, and Dr. King agreed to those restrictions that were intended to minimize the chance that the next march would turn violent.
I found it interesting, and I was trying to, you know, connect the dots when you began talking about James Earl Ray and the new rebel motel, how he was able to maneuver in and out of that place with not a lot of notice by the other guests.
Yeah, so he arrived in the early evening, just as getting dark, and
mm-hmm.
checked in, and the motel clerk, of course, remembered him and had some impressions of him. But then he went straight to his room, and as far as anyone knows, he stayed in his room the rest of the night. So there wasn't much opportunity for the other guests to see him. It wasn't one of these things where they had a breakfast room and where James Earl Ray showed up, and there might have been a dozen people in the breakfast room.
Right.
Nothing like that. So you're right. There was, at least as far as I know, there was no one else at that motel. That's called the New Rebel Motel. No one else who had any recollection of having seen Ray there.
When you were doing your research, were there any aha moments?
There were several. One we've already discussed, and that was the end of police security after 8 hours on that April 3rd. That I hadn't seen that anywhere else. I think I may have been the first to reveal that.
I hadn't seen it either. That's why I was surprised.
That's one thing. Another thing that surprised me was how far behind schedule the SCLC was in organizing the Poor People's Campaign.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to recruit poor people as volunteers to come to Washington and join Dr. King in protests, and they were going to demand extensive federal legislation to end poverty in America. And that's an enormous logistical task to recruit all those people, thousands of poor people. And then they needed to raise money because the costs were going to be considerable. They were going to have to transport people to Washington, and then they were going to have to house them, pay for food. And so it meant a lot of money, and they were fundraising and the recruiting was going very slowly. And that had been mentioned in passing in other places, but I managed to get some documents that showed really how far they had to go before they would have their act together to start the Poor People's Campaign.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Joseph Rosenblum, award-winning journalist and author of Redemption, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Last 31 Hours. I found it interesting because I had never read it before, and I had gone to the Lorraine Motel, but how the Lorraine Motel became the Lorraine Motel.
Well, it was basically a derelict hotel.
Mm-hmm.
When Walter and Lorraine Bailey bought it. And what they did more than anything else is they built an addition, a modern addition, which is what you see there now. And it was the place to go for visiting African American celebrities. The musicians who came to Memphis, the B.B. Kings and the Louis Armstrongs, people like that, would stay. And this was in the era of segregation. They would stay at the Lorraine, and they eventually attracted a reputation and a clientele that made them the premier place for African Americans to stay in Memphis.
Also found it interesting, once Dr. King was shot, all these policemen emerged from around the area, and no one saw James L. Ray at the New Rebel Motel.
Yeah, so what happened there is he had parked his car. He had a Mustang.
A yellow Mustang? Yeah, how can you miss that?
Yeah. Yeah, really. Yeah. It should have stood out, right? I mean, the yellow Mustang.
You would think.
Yeah, you would think. I mean, how many Mustangs are on that street? And but what was what happened is it was the tactical police force that was actually roaming the area that
mm-hmm.
night.
Okay.
During the strike, there were a lot of incidents, and they had these tactical police that were on duty in the nighttime, and they had stopped at a firehouse very near the motel, very
mm-hmm.
near the Lorraine, and they were parked there, and they were having a coffee break. And then the shot rang out, and it just happened that one of the African Americans who was working surveillance and looking at the Lorraine saw the whole thing unfold, saw Dr. King drop, and then he alerted the tactical policeman, and some of them just ran on foot toward the motel and got there pretty quickly. They might have been so distracted in trying to get to the motel that they may not have noticed much. But also James Earl Ray sprinted out of the motel. Rushed to the, he was in such a hurry that he dropped a whole bundle which had a rifle in it and some of his possessions. And it's hard to know why some police officer didn't spot him, but I think it's because they were so preoccupied with the shot and trying to get as quickly as they could to the Lorraine to see what was going on that they didn't. And James O'Reilly was nobody's fool. He probably didn't peel out in that Mustang. He probably started pretty slowly, and maybe he was waiting for the police to run by. Who knows? But anyway, they didn't spot him. At least nobody reported having spotted him there on the street.
We all have heard the recordings from the Free at Last CD about Dr. King's speech that night at Mason's Temple, but no one actually understood that this all was done off the cuff, temporaneously. There was nothing written down.
That's right. He spoke without notes, and he really hadn't prepared anything. He wasn't even going to talk.
Speak, right.
We discussed a minute ago. But he could do that. He was, some people said he had almost a photographic memory.
Mm-hmm.
And also, he would rework some of the same material. So, I mean, a guy like him who's speaking constantly, he couldn't write a new speech every time he spoke. So a lot of the themes and a lot of the language were familiar to him. And he could do that. He could stand up and he could speak for hours and speak very powerfully and very very engagingly for a long time without notes. And that's what happened that night. I don't know, you said you heard that speech. It's an eloquent speech.
Right.
And one can wonder if it would be as well remembered as it is. It's called the Mountaintop Speech.
Exactly.
If it hadn't been killed the next day. But I think that it might well have been, perhaps not as well remembered, but because aspects of that speech were quite extraordinary. I think it would have been remembered anyway.
Right. We know about Ralph Abernathy. We know about Hosea Williams. We know about Jesse Jackson. We know about Andrew Young, James Orange. Who are some of the other aides and confidants around Dr. King at that time when he was in Memphis?
Well, you've named a number. I don't think you mentioned James Bevel.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Bevel and then Kyle. Right.
Well, there were some local people. There
yes.
was Billy Kyles.
Mm-hmm.
He was a local minister, but an old friend of Dr. King's. They went way back. They were both in that circle of Baptist ministers who would meet at conferences and so on. And there was a guy named Ben Hooks, who's a distinguished African-American.
Was chairman of the NAACP, right.
He eventually became chairman of the NAACP, and he then was a judge. He was a
criminal court
judge in Memphis. And he was even, I would guess, that he was a better friend of King's. As a matter of fact, he was on the SCLC board, he was an advisor to King on a lot of issues. Particularly, he helped try to straighten out the SCLC's finances if there was ever an issue there that they needed help. And I did interview him, but he didn't do much during the events of March and April of 1968, because he was a judge and he didn't feel like it was proper for him to be visible, involving himself in any of the campaign there or the strike or anything related to Dr. King's visit.
When I look at some of the pictures, the ones that are included in your book, but other pictures, very seldom do I see Dorothy Cotton.
Yeah, I was disappointed that I didn't have a photo of her. She arrived with Dr. King and three of his aides at the Memphis airport on
right.
the morning of April 3rd. Matter of fact, she was sitting next to Dr. King on the airplane.
Exactly.
And the photo that I have from the afternoon newspaper.
Yeah, after they got off the plane, because I said, well, where's Dorothy?
Good question. And I don't know. Maybe she walked separately from them, but I didn't have a good shot of her in Memphis. She also left. She left on the morning of
April
4th.
Yeah.
So that's maybe she would have been up. There's that iconic photo after King was shot, and he's lying on the floor of the balcony outside the motel, and there's that iconic shot of several of his aides pointing toward the rooming house where James Earl Ray was, because that's where they thought that they had heard the shot emerge from. But she's not in that photo either.
Right.
Yeah. So I think when I interviewed her, I did talk to her. I think she said she was still out in her room and she heard the shot, but maybe by the time she got up there, the photographer wasn't taking those photos. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I also found it interesting. I had never read it before. The last person that Dr. King spoke with, one would have thought it would have been one of his aides prior to him being shot, but it was actually the driver from the funeral home that was lending them a ride.
Yeah, that's right. Last words he heard were from the driver, and the driver, it was a chilly night.
Exactly.
It was turning cool. And the driver said, Dr. King, you don't have your coat. You better get your coat. It's cold out here. And those were the last words that Dr. King heard.
And then the people in the parking lot, his aides thought he was playing around because they were joking prior to that.
Yeah. So among the aides of Dr. King, and there was always a certain kind of a lightheartedness. I think they probably did that to break the tension of of all the danger they were in. And so they were always joking and joshing each other and playing around. And that's what Andrew Young told me. He said he saw Dr. King drop, and he said, oh, he's just faking. And at first, that was his first thought. But it didn't take long at all to realize it wasn't a fake. It was very serious.
A couple of more questions, Mr. Rosenblum. I also found it interesting when you wrote about the aides and the toughness that they had to have, and it wasn't uncommon for them to go about their daily life knowing that at any one given time they could be killed.
That's right. I mean, imagine what it would take to drop everything and join the SCLC. First of all, you're not earning much. They paid just almost starvation wages. Second, you're not building a career somewhere else. You're building a career as a civil rights leader, but you didn't know where that was going to lead. A third, as you said, there was enormous danger. Not only danger when you're demonstrating, because who knew how the police would respond? You probably know what happened on the bridge from Selma, Alabama, when Pettus Bridge, and the attacks by the police there, state troopers, I think. And then also you were in constant danger. It may not even have been protesting, and just someone could very well have attacked you. So there's enormous risk, and that meant that the people who volunteered were both very dedicated.
Mm-hmm.
And second, that they were independent and headstrong, because if they hadn't been independent and headstrong, they wouldn't have left a more conventional life to run those risks and to make those sacrifices.
I also found it interesting that very few autobiography actually focused or dealt with the pressures that it had on Coretta and the family, with him being on the road as often as he was, and the death threats that took place.
Yeah, it was a very tough life for her. The phone would ring at all hours, and she'd pick up the phone, and it would be someone threatening Dr. King. A bomb was thrown on the front porch of their house in Montgomery. It exploded. It was lucky that Coretta King, and then they had one child, that they weren't right near the window there, because they could have been badly hurt. The window shattered. And that was kind of defined what her life was like. She became the housewife and mother. And King and King wanted that from her. He that was by agreement that she would be a traditional wife, and that he would be out on that he would pursue his career as a minister or as a civil rights leader. And he was away a lot. He was on the road an awful lot of the time. So she was alone raising the kids, and without the support of a husband. I don't mean the financial support. I mean the emotional support of a husband who could have helped in all kinds of ways. So that's right. It was a difficult life for her.
Well, you did mention the financial support. He gave most of the money from the Nobel Prize to SCLC, and she finally convinced him to put $20,000 aside for the kids' education and to finally buy a house.
Well, I never actually discovered that he'd given any of the money to anyone or kept any of the money. Except the impression I have is that he donated all the money to the civil rights cause from the Nobel Prize. But he had been happy to rent. He was not interested in material possessions at all. But she finally prevailed on him that they needed a house, and then he agreed. But they bought quite a modest house. I saw the house in Atlanta.
Right, in Vine City.
Vine City, and it has a two-car garage, but they never filled more than one half of it, because they never had more than one car.
Right.
And so they lived simply. They lived quite simply.
I also found it interesting that once King left to go to Memphis, he informed his parents that he may die on that trip.
Yeah, so he already had this sense that he was destined to die early, that someone would kill him. And he did tell his parents that they should be prepared for him to die at any time. That's how deep a dread he had of imminent death and how open he was in discussing it.
Mr. Rosenblum, what you want readers to come away with?
Well, I hope if they look at my book and read my book, and I hope they will, I think it'll give them a deeper appreciation for Dr. King. I think they will come to see how he was coping with incredibly difficult circumstances in the spring of 1968, and what courage he was showing in trying to confront those difficulties, and at the same time, his commitment to doing something about the scourge of poverty in America. I don't think that story is as well known as it should have been, and that's one theme of my book is, and I think you come to see poverty through Dr. King's eyes in a way that helps you understand why he believes that it was so crucial for America to address the issue of poverty far more effectively and more comprehensively than it was doing then. And by the way, I don't think it's done it all that much since then. So I think those are sort of the two of the messages. And the last thing is, I think, just to the emotion of and drama of what happened in Memphis. I think it was a very intense period for him, and I think just reading that and feeling that that emotion and that drama is another thing that I hope people will take from this book.
I understand. How has the critics been towards the book thus far?
I've been very pleased with reception. It's humbling, really. So I've had almost universal approval from critics. I'm still waiting for the next round. But so far, I mean, you figure eventually you got to take your lumps. But so far, I've been really fortunate. People have greeted this this book with tremendous enthusiasm.
Joseph Rosenblum, author of Redemption, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Last 31 Hours, published by Beacon Press. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.